Mr. Mooneyham. Good morning, everyone. Almost said good afternoon, but good to be over here on the west side of the Big Pond. If I mention the two words Middle East, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Muslim countries, biblical history, Al-Qaeda, oil-rich countries, or just a few. How about a peaceful area of the world? No? Well, this area of the world that I would like to discuss today always seems to find its way into our daily news. It's nearly impossible to pick up any nationally syndicated newspaper or watch any cable news network without hearing about the escalating unrest and impending conflict in the Middle East. In fact, recently it has dominated our news pretty much 24 hours a day. It's an area where we hear talk of peace, but of course we know there is none. You know, how many peace summits have there been to try to bring peace to that area of the world? There have been numerous ones, but they still can't find the way to peace. They still can't come up with the right formula to put an end to all the bloodshed. And as long as I can remember, the Middle East has been a hotbed of controversy, turmoil, conflict, and war. The travesties we see, hear, and read about are just mind-boggling. And the fact that some people have such a little regard for human life. So the ultimate question for us today is, why is there no peace in the Middle East? Why is there no peace in the Middle East? Well, first of all, the first thing we need to look at is the fact that God prophesied through the prophet Amos that he would bring his wrath against many of these Middle East nations. Turn, if you will, to Amos, and let's look at some of the excerpts from the first two chapters of Amos that refer to the judgments that God would bring against these countries. First of all, in Amos chapter 1, we'll start reading in verse 3. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Damascus, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have threshed Gilead, and with threshing instruments of iron. So the reason God would bring judgment against Damascus was because they threshed Gilead with implements of sharp iron. According to Bible.org, this referred to the methods of torture where a device like a sledge with iron prongs or knives was used on prisoners, or in some cases huge sledges were literally dragged over the enemies to mutilate and crush them. Of course, as history tells us, part of the judgment could be the fact that Damascus fell to the Assyrians in 732 BC. Before going on to the next country that God has passed judgment against, you notice a phrase that Amos uses repeatedly is, for three transgressions of, and for four. Well, what does this mean? It's a little confusion in that he doesn't list three or four things after he uses that phrase. But some say it's his way to add emphasis to or prep the audience as to what he was about to say. This type formula is occasionally used to emphasize completeness. It's sometimes used to mean a few, one or two of something. It's sometimes used to mean an abundance, as in the case in Micah 5 where 7 or 8 is used. And sometimes it's more literal. The second number is what is being emphasized, and the phrase 3, even 4 is mostly used for poetic parallelism. So this was used by Amos primarily to add emphasis or to set up his audience as to what he was about to say was very important. With that in mind, let's go on and let's look at verse 6 of Amos. Verse 6, thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Gaza and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Why? Because they carried away captive the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. So the major sin here is large-scale slave trade. You know, the Philistines were famous for capturing whole villages of people and selling them into slavery, and where in turn Edom would then sell those slaves to other countries. And now in verse 9, thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Tyrus, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Why? Because they delivered up the whole captivity to Edom and remembered not the brotherly covenant. Of course, this refers to the Phoenicians who were also involved in Edom with slavery. And their sin was even worse in that they had a complete disregard for the family or relatives. It didn't matter if they could sell you as a slave. You know, they would do it whether you were family or not. Well, next to be mentioned is Edom in verse 11. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Edom and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Why? Because he did pursue his brother with a sword, and did cast off all pity, and in his anger did tear perpetually, and kept his wrath forever. So keep in mind, the Edomites were descendants of Esau, Jacob's brother, and of course Jacob's name was eventually changed to Israel. And because he pursued his brother with a sword certainly refers to a relationship that exists between Israel and Edom. Edom's basic sin was its intense hostility and hate for Israel. Are there any countries today that share this feeling of hate and disdain for Israel? We probably could think of a few. Well, Amos continues in verse 13. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of the children of Ammon, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Why? Because they have ripped or mutilated the women with child of Gilead, that they might enlarge their border. According to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the reason they did this horrible and cruel act was that so that they would kind of cut down on the numbers of Israel, and that way they could expand their borders in time. It would give them a better chance to expand. Well, skipping over into chapter 2 now, in verse 1. Chapter 2, verse 1. This saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Moab, and for four I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Why? Because he burned the bones of the king of Edom into lime. Ammon and Moab were daughters of Lot. And this is just another case of relatives fighting amongst themselves. In ancient times, much importance was placed on a dead man's body being peacefully placed in the family burial site. If you remember, they hauled Joseph's bones out of Egypt to make sure they were buried in the Promised Land. So the chief sin of the Moabites was that of desecrating graves. And now verse 4 of chapter 2, Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Judah, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have despised the law of the Lord, and have not kept his commandments. And their lies caused them to err, after which their fathers have walked. Judah's sins, you know, are pretty obvious. Rejecting the laws of God, not keeping God's commandments, and following false gods has ultimately caused them to err. And for this reason, it caused them to walk away, or turn from God's truth. And that's an important lesson for us to learn, is to make sure that we don't follow in those footsteps. And now finally in verse 6, Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Why? Because they sold the righteous for silver, and the poor for a pair of shoes. And he talks about Israel. He goes on to mention additional sins until the end of the chapter. Of course, in verse 6, he talks about selling the righteous for money and the poor for a mere pair of shoes. Verse 7, engaging in pagan practices. Verse 8, abusing the system of pledges and fines. And verse 12, showing lack of respect for God's servants. So here in Amos, we see that God prophesied that the Middle East would be a cursed land. And it would always be at odds with each other, and would always be at odds with the rest of the world. So other than the fact that the Middle East was prophesied to be a cursed land of the world, let's look at three reasons as to why maybe this area of the world has endured so many problems in the past and will continue to do so in the foreseeable future. So one reason there has always been conflict in the Middle East is biblical history. So by biblical history, I mean biblical history between Ishmael and Isaac. So to take an in-depth look at that history, let's turn to Genesis 16. As we turn to Genesis 16, remember that in chapter 13, God promises blessings to Abram's family. He says, Abram, you know, I want you to leave your home, your land. I'm going to expand your family to the extent that it will be as the dust of the earth. And Abram is 75 years old at this time, and he tells God, look, you know, I'm getting pretty old, and we still don't have any kids, and now you're saying that my family is going to be as the dust of the earth. You know, some of us are here myself, well, I'm not 75, but if you're at least 75, what if God told you that? You know, look, I'm going to expand your family to be as the dust of the earth. It will certainly catch you, get your attention. But God reiterates his promise and that he will do what he says. He says to show him again his plan, he tells Abram, look up at the stars in the heavens. Look at the millions and billions of stars. This is what your family, your descendants, are going to be. So he says that the number of your offspring is essentially going to be equal to all the stars in the heavens. So, and by chapter 16, Abram is now 86 years old. In chapter 16 and verse 1, now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abram, see now the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. I wonder how many times she had to tell him. Probably not too many. But anyway, in verse 3, then Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. So what we end up with here is Hagar has now become somewhat contentious, and she's probably thinking, you know, why should I be a handmaiden when I'm carrying Abram's child, his heir? And Sarah is jealous, and she's sorry that she ever came up with this harebrained idea to begin with. And now Hagar, her maidservant, has an heir, and she doesn't. And now down in verses 11 and 12, there's a prophecy stated. Verse 11, and the angel of the Lord said unto her, referring to Hagar, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. That's not exactly the kind of thing you want prophesied about you. You're going to be a wild man. You and your descendants will find it hard to pretty much get along with anyone. Certainly not a good heritage to carry with you through life. Well, in chapter 17, we won't read it, but Abram, who is 99 years old by this time, has his name changed to Abraham, and asked God more or less, you know, why can't you make this covenant with Ishmael? Why do we have to put Sarai, through a childbirth at this late stage in her life when she's already 90 years old? But God tells them, Sarah will bear a son, and they will call his name Isaac, and he will establish his covenant with him, and it will be an everlasting covenant. God says he will make Ishmael a great nation, and that nation is a present-day Arab nations, and most of whom, of course, are Muslim. But he would make Ishmael a great nation, but he'll make his covenant with Isaac. God says he will work with both sons, but for different purposes. And Isaac ultimately replaces Ishmael as the favorite son and heir. Now, of course, this made Ishmael jealous and bitter, and eventually the situation became so intolerable that Sarah demanded that Ishmael and his Egyptian concubine mother be expelled from Abraham's family. But God promised Hagar her son would beget 12 princes who would become a great nation. And at this time, Ishmael went to live in the wilderness region of Hejaz, which is now the Arabian Peninsula. And eventually he did have 12 sons, or 12 princes, and these people are associated with the Midianites, the Edomites, the Egyptians, and the Assyrians. Even though God provided him a great kingdom of his own, for Ishmael, it was never enough. Ishmael and his descendants have always been jealous of the fact that Isaac's descendants were able to claim the full inheritance of Abraham. Author Hal Lindsey recently wrote the following in regards to this scenario between Ishmael and Isaac. Quote, this is exactly the situation that continues to develop in the Middle East. The world has been dragged into the ancient conflict between Isaac and Ishmael in spite of its best efforts to stay out of it. This conflict that has raged between these two half-brothers for 4,000 years is destined to ignite the last war of the world, according to the Bible prophets, unquote. So this jealousy and resentment created an unparalleled hate which has set off wars and atrocities for some 4,000 years. This conflict between the two sons of Abraham has caused friction from the very beginning, has continued throughout the descendants, you know, as we see what's going on today, all over, you know, in that area of the world. You know, look at the tension and the conflict or deception in the stories that we know about Jacob and Esau, or the situation between Joseph and his sons, the jealousy and envy that exists there. So conflicts, to a certain degree, have been predetermined by none other than God himself in some cases. He said there will always be strife and conflict, and what do we see and hear happening in that area of the world today? Strife and conflict and war. You know, if you read a newspaper, watch TV, or listen to the radio, you know what's going on. So biblical history does play a role in why the Middle East is such a strife-torn area of the world, and why there is no peace. A second reason why there is no peace in the Middle East is the crisis over territory or land. The crisis over territory or land. In my preparation, I came across an account that a doctor had with another man on an airplane. It just so happened they were sitting next to each other on an airplane. And this illustration clearly illustrates that a lot of people don't really know what's going on or why things are happening, you know, and what's going on over there. But the man grumbled. He says, "Why don't these stubborn Jews just give back the West Bank to the Arabs so that there can be peace in the Middle East? You know, that'd be nice if it was that easy. Just give back the West Bank and, you know, everything will be fine." We know that won't happen, and it would never happen. But suspecting that the man didn't have the foggiest idea of what he was talking about, the doctor asked him, "Excuse me, sir, where is the West Bank?" "Well, you know," he said. "Yes, I know, but do you know?" "Well, of course I know," the man snapped. "Okay, then, where is it?" Well, he sputtered, "The West Bank is the West Bank of the Nile, right?" Well, the doctor was all he could do to keep from laughing out loud. So here was a man demanding the Israelis surrender the West Bank when he had no idea where the West Bank was even located. The man was embarrassed when the doctor explained that the West Bank of the Nile belonged to Egypt, not Israel. And he was astounded to learn that if Israel were to surrender the real West Bank, the nation would be left in an indefensible position because it would be only 9 miles wide at its narrowest point. So this story illustrates very well the misunderstanding about the crisis in the Middle East that centers around land and the territory and who is a rightful owner. As part of the Abrahamic covenant, God made an unconditional promise to Abraham and his descendants. In Genesis 15, let's go there, Genesis 15. Genesis 15, God spelled out the boundaries of the land he promised to Abraham. In verse 18, Genesis 15, verse 18. "In the same day of the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river of Euphrates. The Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites," almost thought that looks like parasites, but I had to be careful, "the Perizzites and the Rephrams and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Gershishites and the Jebusites." So all kinds of shites, sites. But anyway, if you looked up that map today, this land would include Lebanon, Israel, Syria, large parts of Jordan, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. So who holds the title deed to the land that present-day Israel occupies? Well, the Abrahamic covenant establishes title to the land in the Middle East. According to the Bible, that title was given to Abraham and his descendants by the original owner, God, and the deed belongs to them forever. The Jewish people, the descendants of Abraham, hold the title to the disputed land with no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Now, even though this covenant with Israel was unconditional, there was a covenant that God made with them that was conditional. Right before the children of Israel entered into the promised land, God made a covenant with them that he made it clear to them, look, you have to do certain things. If you want to enjoy this promised land, it will depend totally upon the faithfulness that you have toward me, referring to God. Well, we know that didn't happen, and the Israelites were captured and taken into captivity by the Babylonians. But regardless, even though they were displaced from the land, it still belonged to them via the first covenant, which was unconditional, that God made with Abraham. It would be like if you owned a piece of land that you owned the title deed to, and for some reason, you know, you had to vacate the land, you had to move out of state for some reason or take care of a relative or whatever. But it so happens you had to be gone for, say, 25 or 30 years, and while you were gone, some people moved in, just took up occupation, occupied your land, and they even built homes on the land, maybe even built an entire village. The land is still yours. You still pay the taxes. The deed's still in your name, but someone else is living on your land without your permission. These people have brought with them their own religion. They brought them with them their culture, which could be foreign and even evil. And after 30 years, or whenever you decide to come back, there's even more than one generation now living on this land. And this new generation has been living there all their lives. That's the only land they know. They think it's theirs because they've been living there their entire life. Now, if you decide to return, and you find your land occupied by people who have no right to be there in the first place. So who has the right to the land? The people who have been living there for some odd 30 years, or you, the owner? Well, of course, legally you do. You hold the title deed. It's in your name. Well, this is how it is with the Israelites when they entered the promised land, and it's how it is today. They still have the title deed to the property. Israel is still the deed holder to the land. So let's look now at a biblical example of how land keeps peace from occurring in the Middle East. In Judges 11, we can read about Jephthah. Let's turn to Judges 11. We can read about Jephthah and the role that he played in the squabble over land rights. Here in Judges 11, we learn Jephthah was a mighty man of valor. But he only had one big problem. He was the son of a harlot. And that didn't set too well, of course, with his family. You know, they didn't want him a part of his family because, you know, he was the son of a harlot. So they kicked him out of their family. Well, later when the Ammonites were ready to make war against Israel, all of a sudden they went crying and begging to Jephthah. You know, come back. We need you. Come back. We want you part of our family now. Be our captain. Fight with us against the Ammonites. You know, how would you feel? Yeah, you throw me out, kick me out of your family, you don't accept me as part of your family, but when you get into trouble, you come running and want me to bail you out. Well, finally, he does agree to help them after they promise to make him their head with unlimited authority. So now let's look at Judges 11, and we'll read verse 12, starting verse 12. Now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the people of Ammon, saying, "What do you have against me that you have come to fight against me in my land?" You know, Jephthah asked more or less, you know, why do you want to start a fight? Why do you want to start a war in the first place? What's going on here? Well, the answer is in verse 13. And the king of the people of Ammon answered the messengers of Jephthah, "Because Israel took away my land when they came up out of Egypt from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and to the Jordan. Now, therefore, restore those lands peacefully." In other words, they stole our land, and now we want that land back. Does that sound familiar? Have we ever heard anything like that coming out of the Middle East? We want that land back. A lot of times they seem to think it's holy for some reason or another. We could talk about several examples, but that we want that land back, it belongs to us. You know, how many years have we been hearing those kinds of things, those kind of accusations? Primarily from Arab countries that surround Israel. You possess land that belongs to us, and it's holy ground, and it's time you give it back. Well, so the king of Ammon wants his land back, but Jephthah goes on to explain that the Israelites, they didn't take the land, they didn't steal your land, all they did was want to pass through it. But Sihon attacked Israel anyway and was ultimately defeated by the hand of God, and thus the Israelites possessed the country of Sihon where the Ammonites happened to live. And let's look now at verse 23. So Jephthah responds in verse 23. "So now the Lord God of Israel has depossessed you, or put out the Amorites from before his people Israel. Should you then possess it?" He says, what? You want us to just give it back? You want us to give it back after God has delivered it to us? He says, I don't think so. Of course, later the Ammonites were defeated and the conflicts and scenarios continue today. They fought over land then, land they believed belonged to them, and still today, for that reason, land and territories continue to play a major role into why there is no peace in the Middle East. But finally, a third reason there is no peace in the Middle East is religious differences. Religious differences. We'll stay right here in Judges 11, but we'll look at verse 24. Judges 11, verse 24, "Will you not possess whatever Chemosh your God gives you to possess? So whatever the Lord our God takes possession of before us, we will possess." He says, look, you possess what your God gives to you, and we'll possess what our God gives to us. And that's one of the major problems, that each side has its own God. Each side believes their God gave the land to them, and that land, in certain cases, is holy to them. They don't worship the same God, they don't have the same rituals or ceremonies, and certainly they don't keep the same laws. They don't practice the religion the same way, and hence we have so much strife and confusion because each side believes they are right, and their God is the one and only true God. Well, at this juncture, I think it would be good to look at some of the differences between Islam and maybe Christianity or some of the other religions of the world. I'll just enumerate some of the things that I took out of the Quran. I don't know if any of you ever read that, but it's interesting. But anyway, here's some of the things that are about Islam. According to Islam, there is an afterlife experienced as either an ideal life of paradise for faithful Muslims or hell for those who are not Muslims. There is no atonement for sins other than a sincere confession of sin and repentance by the sinner. The Bible is corrupt and is only correct if it agrees with the Quran. Jesus did not die on the cross. Instead, God allowed Judas to look like Jesus, and he was crucified instead. God is known as Allah, and there is no other God in existence. Heaven is paradise to Muslims, where the desires of the faithful Muslims are met. And the purpose of the women in paradise is solely for the pleasure of the men. Hell is a place of eternal punishment and torment for those who are not Muslims. Jesus is not the Son of God and certainly is not divine. The Quran is the final revelation to all mankind given through Gabriel to Muhammad. It is without error. Man is not made in the image of God. Muhammad is the last and greatest of all prophets of Allah, whose Quran is the greatest of all inspired books. Forgiveness of sins is obtained by Allah's grace without a mediator. The Trinity is the Father, Jesus, and Mary. You know, there are many differences, but I think we can see that the thread of contention that exists or can exist because of these many differences between the different religions. Both sides, or all sides, believe God is on their side. In the war between Iraq, I'm sure probably all of us remember Saddam Hussein claiming that God was on his side. God was on the side of the Muslim world. We heard him say, you know, Americans are the enemy of God. They are the great Satan. And he proclaimed that God would deliver Iraq from the great evil invaders. And that proclamation didn't turn out too well. So all sides believe God is on their side, even if they are the evil ones. In his final teachings on the Passover, Jesus Christ makes a statement to the disciples that I'm sure probably sent chills down their spine. I would say it certainly made them a little bit leery. Let's go to John 16. John 16, and we'll read verses 1 and 2. John 16, verse 1. "These things have I spoken unto you, that you should not be offended or made to stumble." Verse 2. "They will put you out of the synagogues. Yes, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers or does God a service." People kill in the name of religion. Many kill in the name of the Muslim religion. I hope we all know and understand that the ultimate goal of the Muslim religion is to control the entire world. The Quran spells this out, and this is to be accomplished by whatever means necessary. To succeed in this, they must kill all the infidels. So what's an infidel? Infidels refer to those who are unbelievers and refuse to accept Allah as the one true God. So I guess that makes us all infidels. Christ even told the disciples that Jews would kill them in the name of religion. You know, just look at all the suicide bombers you hear about all the time. They kill themselves and others because, you know, they think they're doing God a service. They think they'll get a better reward if they kill themselves for what they believe they're doing a service to God. And the more people they can take with them, the better. The Muslims think God is on their side. The Jews think God is on their side. The Arabs think God is on their side. And yes, the Christians think God is on their side. And some people will blow themselves up thinking they are worshiping God. In Islam, there is no guarantee of salvation except for in one instance. There's only one instance that guarantees them salvation: dying in jihad. Have you ever heard that term before? Jihad. Jihad is the struggle, the battle against those who would oppose Islam and what Islam stands for. The whole Islamic system of salvation is based upon works and fighting in jihad. And that's why Muslim terrorists are so eager to die and take others with them for the cause of their religion. That's the only way they can be guaranteed paradise, is to die in jihad. This is the fundamental principle in Islam that encourages terrorism. In John 18:35, Pilate, in talking to Jesus Christ, he says, "Look, am I a Jew? You know, it's your own religious system that's trying to kill you and put you to death. You know, what have you done?" Of course, the Jews didn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God. And all this goes to show that religious differences play a major role as to why people are willing to kill others and kill in the name of their God, and why there is no peace in the Middle East. So we've seen that there are at least three variables that play a role in why that area of the world has been a constant conflict to some degree or another. We've seen that biblical history pertaining to Ishmael and Isaac and the promises God made has continued even until today. Also, the fighting over land and territory that people believe God gave to them has and will continue to be a reason for the problems that exist in the Middle East. And finally, we've seen that religious differences make people willing to kill others in the name of God. Sadly, man will not and cannot solve this generational problem. We've seen what is a problem or the causes of the lack of peace in the Middle East. So what's the answer? What will happen or must happen in order for this to change? What changes must be made so that when they cry peace, there will be peace? Christians, Jews, and even Muslims are all looking for the return of their respective Messiah. In Revelation 19, we can read about Jesus Christ, the one and only true Messiah. Let's go to Revelation 19. The one and only true Messiah that will return to put an end to this situation once and for all. In Revelation 19, verse 11. "And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he does judge and make war." Now skip down to verse 14. "And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God." In verse 16, "And he has on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." Finally, after millennia of animosity, bloodshed, and war, there will be peace in the Middle East, and this peace will extend throughout the rest and the entire world. God's government will be established here on earth and put an end to all situations such as the one that exists in the Middle East, and for that matter, all over the world, the unrest, the wars and the conflicts and the hatred. As we all know, the Middle East is a very volatile area of the world. And as we've seen, it's been going on for an awful long time, and it will continue to be going on unless Jesus Christ returns and sets up God's government where no one will harm anyone in all his holy mountain. Until the establishment of God's kingdom, we'll not see peace. Only when Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace, is ruling over this planet will the Middle East and the rest of the world have peace that it's long yearned for. So in closing, brethren, let's continue to pray with fervency, please God, thy kingdom come. And in doing so, we can all look forward to what we're told in Isaiah 9, verse 7, of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end.